Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law. Talking Law. Talking Law. Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases in the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more. Straight talk, no nonsense. Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
February 18th, 2015. Good morning, Talking Law fans. This is your host, Dan Hochheiser, broadcasting to you live from Lower Manhattan on this cold February New York morning. I hope everybody is warm. We have a great show today. Talking Law is a radio show which seeks to entertain, educate, and include you in the conversation about all the hottest and important legal issues of the day. I encourage everybody to listen to our prior shows on blogtalkradio.com/talkinglaw, like our Facebook page, facebook.com/talkinglaw. Please follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, Hochheiser. Last week's show was fantastic. We had Oberlin College professor and author Renee C. Romano, and we discussed her book, Racial Reckoning, Prosecuting America's Civil Rights Murders. It was a fascinating discussion about the evolution of racial tension in the South, particularly in Mississippi, from the 1950s through the present, and the prosecutions that have and have not taken place. Today's show, I'm very excited about. We have a fantastic guest. We are joined by Ronald T. Hosko, who is a former assistant director of the FBI. Currently, he is the president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. He has a very impressive resume, and I'm going to give him a proper introduction, although it is a bit lengthy, but he deserves it. After graduating from the Temple University School of Law, Mr. Hosko began his work as a special agent in Jackson, Mississippi. In the late 1980s, he transferred to Chicago, working undercover. He served on both the Jackson and Chicago SWAT teams, targeting the most dangerous subjects of FBI investigations. He went on to lead the FBI's crisis management unit in Quantico, Virginia, before serving as an assistant special agent in charge in Philadelphia from 2003 to 2007. He was awarded the FBI's Shield of Bravery for his actions during a violent ransom kidnapping. He also served as an inspector, where he conducted multiple serious and fatal shooting investigations involving FBI and associated law enforcement personnel, and led an important 20-year review of FBI shooting incidents. Ron was promoted to serve as special agent in charge of the Washington Field Office's Criminal Division, overseeing all criminal and cyber cases. In 2012, he was asked to serve as an assistant director of the FBI's Criminal Investigation Division. Let me rephrase that. He was asked to serve as assistant director of the FBI's Criminal Investigative Division. He was responsible for oversight of the organization's largest program worldwide. He has tremendous experience in the response to and management of critical incidents, having served in important roles at the Salt Lake City and Torino, Italy Olympics, World Cup, national political conventions, and events including the Oakdale prison siege, 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, and many others. So without further ado, I bring you Ron Hosko. Mr. Hosko, are you with me?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Doing great. A little bit chilly, but good to go.
Where are you, Virginia?
I'm in Virginia, yep.
Even cold down there. Unbelievable.
We're in the cold.
I was in Vermont for a couple days, and it was absolutely ungodly, about negative 20 with the wind chill. And I'm actually happy to be back in New York, where it's, you know, only single digits or so. In any event, we have had some news from the FBI director, James Comey, who made some statements which I actually thought were incredibly honest. I thought they were things that needed to be said by a law enforcement leader. The gist of what he said was that police do use race in confronting suspects, but they don't use it because of racism. They use it because of factors related to their on-the-job, in-the-street experience. Mr. Hosko, I want to get your reaction to those comments, and if you don't mind, we're going to play an audio clip of FBI Director Comey's statement, and then I want to get your reaction, if that's okay.
Go ahead. Yep.
Okay, play the tape.
With the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, the death of Eric Garner in Staten Island, and the ongoing protests throughout the country, and the assassinations of NYPD officers Wenjun Liu and Rafael Ramos, we are at a crossroads. As a society, we can choose to live our lives every day, raising our families, going to work, and hoping that someone, somewhere, will do something to ease the tension, to smooth over the conflict. We can roll up our car windows, turn up the radio, and drive around these problems. Or we can choose instead to have an open and honest discussion about what our relationship is today, what it should be, what it could be, what it needs to be. Something happens to people in law enforcement. Many of us develop different flavors of cynicism that we work hard to resist because they can be lazy mental shortcuts. For example, criminal suspects routinely lie about their guilt, and nearly everybody that we charge is guilty. That makes it easy for some folks in law enforcement to assume that everybody's lying and that no suspect, regardless of their race, could be innocent. Easy, but wrong. Likewise, police officers on patrol in our nation's cities often work in environments where a hugely disproportionate percentage of street crime is committed by young men of color. Something happens to people of goodwill working in that environment. After years of police work, officers often can't help but be influenced by the cynicism they feel. A mental shortcut becomes almost irresistible and maybe even rational by some lights. The two young black men on one side of the street look like so many others that officer has locked up. Two white men on the other side of the street, even in the same clothes, do not. The officer does not make the same association about the two white guys, whether that officer is white or black. And that drives different behavior.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I am joined by former Assistant Director of the FBI, Ron Hosko. We just listened to a clip of FBI Director James Comey discussing the issue of law enforcement using race on the job when they're confronting suspects. Mr. Hosko, you just listened to Director Comey's comments. What are your thoughts? Is he correct that law enforcement is using race while doing their job?
Well, I think that the director was making reference to what some refer to as unconscious bias. We are all the product of our environment, of the people that we encounter, of our engagement with those people. And, you know, that shapes us. It shapes you. It shapes me every day. And I think that's the director's core commentary, is that we are all shaped by these events in our lives that may create unconscious biases that those in law enforcement, actually all of us, need to resist and take a new encounter as a new encounter. But the truth is that after months or years and years of contact with people in our society, it changes us. And it's incumbent on law enforcement officers not to get lazy and understand this engagement, today's encounter, based on the 100 or 100,000 that I've had in the past, but to take every person as an individual.
And so what should be done or can be done, or maybe nothing should be done, maybe it's okay. The director spoke of a situation where a law enforcement officer is in two different situations, one in which he sees two black guys on the side of the street, and the other in which he sees two white guys on the side of the street wearing identical clothing, but reacts differently to viewing the two black guys than the two white guys, seeing the two black guys as a threat. What can we do in terms of training, in terms of, I don't know, different procedures or protocols to make sure that every suspect gets a fair shake, or is that naive? Should we not be doing that?
No, I think we should be doing that. That's idealistic. In a perfect world, we take the best candidates who a psychological exam and interviews would say is really entering the business of law enforcement to be involved in public service. That should be the core mission of everybody in law enforcement, to keep our society safe, to keep its members safe. And that's a tough job. On any given day, that's a tough job. And it's a harder job in some of these places. The inner cities, are typically the case where it is much harder. You're facing frequently people who are engaged in criminality, and you're trying to purge your mind of what happened yesterday and not have it influence what happens today. So it involves hiring the right people. It involves a cycle of training so that you keep that public service mentality throughout your career. That training is not without a cost. I know that a lot of police departments today across the country, they have had both pay compression and personnel compression over the 90s and into the 2000s, where budgets were limited and departments shed employees. So we're expecting the same level of service from fewer employees in a lot of places across the country. To effectively train your workforce in that sort of environment is a challenge. And you need look no further than the report that came out on the Secret Service, maybe 6 weeks ago, from four seasoned professionals that raised concerns about the level of training, particularly within the uniform division of the Secret Service, those who are guarding the White House and its occupants. And when you start to measure meaningful training in terms of minutes per year, that's a problem. But the report went on to talk about the need to hire many more people. That's a reflection of, and it's going to be an indicator of, what's the status of your training. Because if I have to keep my people on patrol, I can't put them in a classroom to make them smarter and keep them where they need to be.
Now, Mr. Hosko, I'm always interested in how my guests got to their station in their career. You have had a tremendously successful career, rising to be assistant director of the FBI and now leading the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. When did you first decide that you wanted to be in public service and that specifically you wanted to join the FBI? What went into that decision?
From a fairly early age, I was a Boy Scout many, many moons ago. And when I made the rank of Eagle Scout, they asked you what sort of profession you were interested in, and they matched you up with a sponsor for a recognition dinner. And my sponsor was a gentleman from the Pennsylvania State Police. And everything he said just drew me in further to a career in law enforcement. I actually applied for Pennsylvania State Police back in the 80s. And subsequently went to law school and decided I wanted to get into the FBI, which is a bounty of opportunities, particularly today because it's a global organization with so many opportunities to specialize, whether you want to be on a SWAT team or an evidence team or a crisis negotiation team. apart from your day job, which is conduct criminal investigations or national security investigations, there are a lot of collateral duties that you can get involved with based on your interests. So that was the path I took. I was fortunate enough to get in. I will say that the candidate pool for the FBI, it just is a wealth of amazing talent and capability. Even more so, perhaps now, with what's going on in our world on cyber, with soldiers who have led people into battle and are bringing back to the FBI experiences from overseas, tremendous leadership. So, you know, it was a wonderful opportunity for me and a career I have no regrets about.
And for somebody listening who might be considering what to do with their career, what types of people is the FBI currently looking for? Are they looking for people who have technical experience, say, in cyber counterterrorism or speaking Arabic? Or what are the types of skills that could help somebody get a position with the FBI?
I think those that you just touched on. Certainly, as our world changes and the cyber threat becomes so much more obvious and pronounced and impactful, the FBI is looking for people with cyber skills. They are always looking for people with a range of language skills that would allow the organization to penetrate criminal and national security schemes and defeat plots against our citizens. Those who, again, as I said, you know, bring back experiences from the battlefield, I think are viewed in a special light in the FBI and should be. So, you know, those who have served, I think, are getting particular attention. And then, you know, the traditional skills of accountants and of attorney, you know, people with legal backgrounds like myself, the average age in the FBI has really shifted. Back when I joined, it was the typical agent joining the FBI was in his early 20s, and now they're closer to 30 years old. And that is because the organization is looking for people with experience and with proven leadership, which are assets.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking to former Assistant Director of the FBI, Ron Hosko, who is now President of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. Mr. Hosko, can you tell our listeners what the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund has been set up to do? What kinds of work are you doing there? How can people get involved to support the organization?
I can. The organization was set up over 20 years ago, and really the principal focus for many, many years was on the raising funds to defend individual officers who were accused of misconduct and typically the use of force, and some involvement with the use of force, you know, not defending those who are accused of corruption or other nefarious acts, which actually was part of my job, you know, in the FBI, but it is typically the use of force cases. And if you think about what happened in Ferguson this summer, that would be a prototypical case where the organization would look hard at the facts and make a determination as to whether we would try to raise funds to support an accused police officer, where they have to make a life and death sometimes decision. A fateful decision that is life-changing. These are decisions that we know, and I know from my own experience, I know of no officers who want to get up in the morning and shoot somebody or take their life. These are momentous decisions for law enforcement. They are life-changing decisions. They can financially cripple an officer who made a hard decision because he felt he had to. And so we're looking for those sorts of cases.
Did the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund help Police Officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson?
We did not. Part of my engagement since I've been here is to try to expand our associations and be a voice on the broader law enforcement issues as well as individual officer defense. And so I engaged with and spoke to folks at the FOP and tried to offered our potential services. Of course, we're not going to make a decision unless we know in great detail what actually occurred.
Mr. Hosko, what's the FOP for those of us who
It's the Fraternal Order of Police. A lot of police officers are members of an association or a benevolent group like the FOP. In the case of the FBI, there's an FBI Agents Association. For Federal Law Enforcement Officers, there's an association. And frequently those groups will provide you some essential and critical level of legal services if you're accused in some manner. In this case, because of the nature of the allegations, I thought it was appropriate to reach out to the FOP and at least start a discussion. Now, the truth is, I believe a great deal of money has been raised for Officer Wilson for a potential defense, and certainly to give him some level of protection as the events have unfolded. So the sense was that they didn't need the help of our organization, and that's fine.
Is there a website for the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund that people can go to get more info?
www.leldf.org, Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund.org.
Okay, folks, go to that website.
There's a good example of our cases in there, some of the cases that we've taken on. Two of them over the last few months were dismissed, one after the beginning of a trial and another one at a preliminary hearing where a young officer was accused of manslaughter, charged with it, indicted for it, and we got the facts and thought this officer needs our assistance. And, in fact, a judge throughout the manslaughter charge, essentially finding that the absence of evidence that the prosecution could prove that officer's life is forever changed.
Well, it sounds like the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund has filled a necessary gap and is doing important work. Mr. Hosko, we don't have a lot of time left together, but before you go, I'm trying to develop on this show a record of people's experiences on September 11th, 2001. We had former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez on the program, and we had former Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik, who both shared their 9/11 experiences with our listeners. And I know that during 9/11, I believe you were chief of a crisis management unit for the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to hear about where you were at about 7:30 in the morning on 9/11 and what you did and how you reacted when you learned that the first plane hit the World Trade Center.
Well, I was actually in San Francisco soundly sleeping. We and myself and my unit and a number of other components of our critical incident response group in Quantico were in San Francisco planning a crisis management exercise that day. And I got a call from a secretary back east here asking me, Ron, have you seen the news? And, of course, with the time difference, I hadn't. And she said, turn on the TV. So we immediately gathered in what was initially supposed to be a crisis management training exercise in San Francisco, gathered their crisis management components, and went about our work, which was at that time trying to identify particularly Flight 93, where it was, because the other planes had struck by that time. And so as we were tracking that and taking calls from the public and trying to, go real time with a crisis, actual crisis, we turned on that mechanism within the FBI in the San Francisco office. Later that day, we were able to, through the help of United Airlines, load our staff, which was dozens of people who were the core of the FBI's crisis response, at San Francisco Airport and fly back to Reagan International.
Wow.
It was momentous.
Yeah, that was a terrible day. And how did that impact your experience in the FBI? Did the organization change after that? What was the atmosphere like, the difference between the atmosphere before 9/11 versus after?
Well, you're touching on it. I think those of us who were in the organization at that time, as many citizens who are adult now, have their pre-9/11 life and their post-9/11 life. And the director of the FBI, Bob Mueller, was in the director for about a week before 9/11. I was actually in my new job as the chief of my unit for a like period of time. And it changed the FBI dramatically. It was certainly the opening days of it were totally chaotic as the public called in, wrote in, notified us of anything that they thought was suspicious, and we waded through literally mountains of complaints and tips and clues. But it changed the organization because once upon a time we were patient and we watched as threats developed and congealed, and it became quite clear post 9/11 that we have to be fully in front of these threats. And you see how the FBI interdicts perceived threats now and has probably identified and convicted several dozen people for threat plotting here domestically. That became mission one of the FBI, which is defeat these threats before they occur.
Mr. Hosko, I have to wrap it up, but my last question for you, and if you could just give me no more than 30 seconds, I'd appreciate it. Are we safer in America today than we were on September 12, 2001?
I wish I could say we are, but I think the threat has metastasized. The core Al-Qaeda threat was really beaten badly by the U.S. government efforts across government, and now that threat has metastasized across North Africa, into the Eastern, in the Arabian Peninsula, across Asia, and the fear of self-radicalizers, of travelers, is prevalent. It is really a great concern for the FBI. I think the threat has changed. It is not as, I don't think it will be as impactful with a 9/11 style attack, but softer targets are easier targets. And I fear for us, doesn't mean there's not a great intelligence community pushing on these threats every day, because they are.
Ron Hosko, thank you so much for joining us. Please visit the website leldf.com to learn more about... leldf.org to learn more about the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund and how you can get involved in helping our police officers who find themselves in trouble. Mr. Hosko, I hope you'll come back and join us. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Dan. Thank you.
Take care. Now, before we get to Beth Karras, KarrasOnCrime.com, we have the Talkin' Law Radio question of the day. The question of the day is, what are Talkin' Law Radio's top five mob movies of all time? After Beth Karras, I'll give you the answer. Now, give me Beth Karras.
Talkin' Law Radio brings you a live Karras on Crime special report from Beth Karras, former prosecutor, Court TV, HLN television correspondent, and founder of KarrasOnCrime.com. Now here's Beth with the latest legal news.
Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
Go ahead. I want to hear you tell me what the temperature is in Arizona.
Well, it is going to be 80, but it's not there yet because it's still morning. It's about 8 o'clock, so it's a little bit cooler, but it's going to be about 80 degrees. Yeah, but I walked in New York over the weekend. Frigid as it was, I enjoyed it.
Okay, well, you get credit for that. So,
yeah.
Jody Arias, we have some progress since we last spoke last week. We have the prosecution's rebuttal case rested.
Yes, and the defense's rebuttal, sir rebuttal, really, is going to begin today, shortly, in about an hour and a half, and is expected to last just 2 days this week and up to 4 days next week. Now, that should be the end of the evidence. I don't know if the state is going to put on more witnesses. I guess they could, but there's been no notice given of it at this point, so it looks like the evidence is going to wrap up by the end of next week, and hopefully closing arguments will be the first week of March. The problem is, from my perspective, problem, because I want to come home, is the deliberation time. I have been told that in recent cases, capital cases, in the life-death verdict, you know, decision, because there's three different verdicts they render here in Arizona. First, the guilt. Then there's a verdict on whether or not the aggravator, one or more aggravators, was proven. And then there's the mitigation verdict, you know, the life or death. And in one recent case, last year, the jury deliberated for 5 weeks just between life and death and ultimately went with life. Another case, 3 weeks. So I have no idea if the case going to the jury the first week of March means it'll be over the second week of March.
So what is your plan? I mean, are you going to stick it out for a little while and see what happens, or?
I don't know, Dan. That's the quandary I'm in. I launched this website so I can cover this trial. A lot of my fans for years when I was at Court TV were telling me, go there, cover it for us. We want to hear from you. I can't leave them at the end. But I have a show that I'm in New York at the end of March, so I'm going to have to get back to New York at some point.
Tell us about the show. What's the show?
Well, that's the Inner Circle show. It's a New York City journalist who every year put on a sort of a political satire comedy dinner theater at the New York Hilton. It's been on around since 1923. It's an annual charity event. The mayor puts on the third act. Remember when Rudy Giuliani dressed in drag? It was that show. Do you remember that? Yeah, okay, it's that show. So
of course.
Mayor de Blasio will be putting on his second show this year. So I'm in it. I'm chairman. I was, president of the organization last year. And I'm, you know, I have a rehearsal tonight that I can't be at, singing and dancing. So it's too bad.
You're the president? You know, I didn't see my invitation.
I was.
Unbelievable.
I was president last year. I was very busy last year. Now I'm a figurehead. I'm chairman this year, so it's really just a figurehead.
Gotcha.
It's a great organization. You should come to the show.
Yeah, I'd love to. In terms of the rest of the defense, I guess, what is it, a surrebuttal case now? What do you expect that to consist of?
Well, it's going to just be more psychologists talking about whether Jodi Arias has borderline personality disorder or PTSD. Yeah, anything to try to convince this jury that, you know, she deserves life over death. And then they're also going to be putting on one or two experts to deal with whether there was pornography on Travis Alexander's computer. Frankly, I think everyone's kind of lost sight of the issues here. The porn on the computer is just not that important anymore, in my opinion. It's a heavily litigated issue, I think, for an appeal, because the state represented there was no porn on Travis Alexander's computer during the guilt phase, and there was indeed porn. What does this mean? I don't know that it would have swayed a jury to vote something less than first-degree murder, but it might convince a couple jurors that, yeah, she deserves life, not death. But if the jury's deadlocked this time, it's a life sentence anyway. But there's so much other legal news going on around the country that it's frustrating that I'm here for 6 months covering this story that everybody kind of knows already.
And what are some of the other cases that you have your eye on?
Well, I'm focusing on James Holmes, which is in jury selection. That's the Colorado theater shooting case. Obviously, he did it. The issue there is insanity. But they're taking a long time picking a jury. They started January 20th, and they hope that openings will be the end of May. But the first phase, which was kind of the initial screening of jurors, ended early. Instead of going through, the judge had allotted a month, January 20th to roughly a month, February 20th, it ended. And a week ago today, they started phase two, which is individual voir dire. But, you know, it's a little county. They summoned 9,000 jurors, but let 2,000 go when the first phase ended early. So now this individual voir dire examining mental illness and the death penalty, because they're seeking death, is bogging them down. And the judge is rehabilitating some of the jurors who say they don't believe in the death penalty, and that's raising some issues. Because, you know, some are wondering whether or not rehabilitating a juror who's against the death penalty to say, well, I guess under certain circumstances I could impose death, is really putting an anti-death penalty person in the pool. So that's an issue. And then
Beth,
have there been
any motions to change venue in the James Holmes Colorado Theater shooting case?
You know, I believe that there were early on. You know, this shooting is already a couple of years old, but, you know, clearly denied. I mean, this is a state case happening there, you know, where it happened. And one out of nine residents or something were summoned. I mean, it's a fairly small county. And, I mean, there's a woman in the jury pool who said, well, my daughter was supposed to go to the show that night, but didn't, you know, at the last minute. And, you know, she's sort of wondering if how she would feel. Is she gonna put herself in the position of the parents of those who died and the 70 who were injured? And she's in the pool. So, you know, I think they'll probably get a jury. The judge is trying to get 100 to 120 people, and then each side has 22 peremptories. But it's going
to
take a while.
Sounds like it's going to be very difficult to get a fair jury. However, do you think that's going to be the next case you cover, or do you
think you might be going elsewhere? Yeah, I'll be focusing on that. You know, there's a case in Atlanta that I've got my eyes on, but you know, it was supposed to be in trial right now in the month. Well, last month it was supposed to start, and then they took it off the docket, and there's no trial date set. And that's the case of Justin Ross Harris, who is accused of murder for leaving his toddler in his car. This is an Atlanta suburb in Cobb County. And his child died because of the heat in the car. And he was sexting and, you know, with a minor and doing all kinds of things that he shouldn't have been doing as a parent with a toddler in the car. So he's charged with murder, and that's a case that has a lot of appeal, especially to my fans, a lot of whom are, you know, mothers and grandmothers who, you know, just can't relate to a father leaving a child to die in a car, forgetting about him, allegedly. So that is a trial I have my eyes on. Obviously, we're all looking at the Sarnaev trial up in Boston, the marathon bombing trial. And then in your backyard, H.M. Pace, that trial is going on. That trial takes us back decades to the little boy who went missing in 1979, and his alleged killer confessed to it and is now on trial all these years later.
Well, it sounds like if the Jody Arias case ever finishes up, you're going to have plenty to do. So going back to the Atlanta case, I think I recall that the suspect in that case, the father, didn't he go to work after he left the kid car with the windows up?
Well, I don't remember if it was work or if he went, you know, into a store or something, because I'm tracking the case, but I can't tell you I know all the facts. But yes, there was something really negligent. He was sexting also with toddlers. I mean, with an undercover underage person. And you know, it's believed that he may have known what he was doing. It wasn't that it was just a reckless, depraved act, but it was intentional.
It's unbelievable. It's bad enough when people leave a dog in the car, but to leave a child like that is that's a nasty allegation. So those defense lawyers will have their work cut out for them in Atlanta. What else is happening in the world of Beth Karras?
Well, and, you know, there's a trial coming up in Los Angeles, too. The Grim Sleeper, they call it. He's a serial killer, alleged serial killer, and he's charged with killing 10 women. His trial's coming up in the summer. Well, let's see if it actually goes this time. He's been locked up for years, but he probably killed far more than that. But they call him the Grim Sleeper. And, of course, I've got my eyes on Suge Knight's murder charges in Los Angeles, and we'll see what happens with the wrongful death complaint that's been filed by the daughter of Joan Rivers for her untimely death in New York.
Now, Beth, if listeners want the latest news, one-stop shopping for the Jody Arias case, how can they get that information on KarrasOnCrime.com?
Well, KarrasOnCrime.com is a subscription site. You go to the public homepage. That's free. You can get a little sneak peek into what's inside for the Arias case. I also have about 350 pages of court documents on the Aaron Hernandez case up, but it's $5.99 a month, and I will be expanding to other trials. Obviously, I launched this for the Arias trial, and it really is one-stop shopping for the Arias trial. It's pretty comprehensive, and I have more exclusive documents to come on the site. So there's a lot there if you're interested in really, really learning the one case, and I will be branching out to other cases as soon as Arias is over.
Beth Karas, KarasOnCrime.com. Beth, thanks as always for being with us. We'll speak to you next week.
My pleasure.
Now, before we get to the answer to the question of the day, I want to let you know that next week we are going to have a great guest. We're going to have George Anastasia, who is author of Gotti's Rules, the story of John Elite, Junior Gotti, and the demise of the American Mafia. Don't miss that show next Wednesday morning, 9:30 a.m. So, in that vein, the question of the day is, what are Talkin' Law Radio's top five mob movies of all time? The answer, number 5, Bugsy. Number 4, Casino. Number 3, Pritzi's Honor. Number 2, Goodfellas. And number 1, The Godfather. Now, before I leave you, I do need to do an obituary, because we lost a giant of the legal profession this past Thursday. Harold Price Faringer passed away at the age of 87. He was a tremendous First Amendment and criminal defense lawyer. He represented many adult entertainment establishments throughout New York City, including video stores and theaters, in a battle over zoning laws instituted under the administration of Rudolph Giuliani. He is well known for his work on the defense of the Larry Flint case, who was the publisher of Hustler magazine, and also for representing Frank Lucas, who is an alleged drug dealer whose life and times were memorialized in the movie American Gangster. Harold Price Faringer was a lawyer's lawyer. He argued cases before the Supreme Court. He tried many cases. He was a fantastic storyteller. He was what I view as what every trial lawyer and appellate lawyer should aspire to be, a true gentleman, by all accounts, a great person, and it is a great loss to the bar to have lost Harold Price Faringer, who I had the privilege to watch lecture many times, and I recommend, if you can get a hold of some of his old lectures on opening statements, jury selection, closing arguments, appellate practice, it will be well worth your time. Truly one of the greats. My condolences go out to the Harold Price Faringer family. We are indebted to his work that he did over so many years in the profession. I want to thank Ron Hosko, president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund, LELDF.org, who is former assistant director of the FBI. I want to thank Beth Karas, KarasOnCrime.com. I want to thank my producer, Mark Goldman, who always does such a great job. I want to invite everybody to join us next week, Wednesday, 9:30 a.m., when I will have George Anastasia, author of Gotti's Rules, the story of John Elite, Junior Gotti, and the demise of the American Mafia. Please listen to all our prior podcasts on blogtalkradio.com/talkinlaw. Like our Facebook page, facebook.com/talkinlaw. Follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, HOCHHEISER. Send me an email, talkinlaw@gmail.com. Let me know what your top five mob movies of all time are. I will see you next week. Everybody stay warm, and I wish you peace and justice.